Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Tonight is Thursday, April 9th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, and then address, we're not going to do an Ask Catherine session. We're going to address questions with Franklin Sanders. I'm over at Franklin Sanders Farm for our precious metals update this week. And after we do the precious metals update, we're going to talk about the new thriller, The International, starring Clive Owens in our Let's Go to the Movies segment, which is really a fantastic movie. If you haven't seen it yet, please do. A fantastic movie to really describe the economic model that we're all really in one way or another having to deal with and being drained by. It's a great description. Okay, money and markets. If you've been following the blog, you know there's an awful lot going on this week. We've had a wonderful interview by Bill Moyers with William Black, who was a bank regulator that really does an excellent job of laying out what everyone in this call probably already knows, but that the entire housing bubble and the debt problem in America was intentionally created and is real fraudulent inducement. In other words, a great deal of debt was intentionally created by Wall Street and Washington with the full knowledge that Americans could never afford to pay it back. And this is under the law. This is what I call fraudulent inducement. And it's a, you know, Moyers does a very professional job of walking Black through his background and understanding as a bank regulator of what happened. And it's a great view to help you understand. Now, sometimes it's hard for honest people to fathom that something that evil was intentionally engineered, but I think it does a great job of sort of laying it out and explaining it. Now, up on the blog underneath it is a video done by a financial analyst in Argentina, where he talks about the Argentina experience, and it's not as excellent as the Moyers in the sense that he's a little bit angry, and he's a little bit passionate about what could go wrong in America. And I don't think that that's necessarily the best spirit to understand this information. But if you really track and understand what's happened in Argentina or countries around the world where we've had this, sort of this financial competition between the people who are engineering the, you know, gross over-issuance of debt versus the real economy, it really helps you to see an example of that. It's run down through the blog, and so you have to click over to the other, but there's a wonderful chart I put up that showed a picture of the planet with $55 trillion gross global product, if you will, the global equivalent of world domestic, or of what we call GNP, gross national product, and then an upside-down triangle that goes from $55 trillion of world economic product all the way up to $1,200 in derivatives. And you really range up from that which is real to that which is not real. And it's a wonderful triangle to kind of look at to get the big picture of why there's a competition going on between this this unreal financial world that's just sucking resources up to try and keep their game going and the real economy. And what we've seen in the U.S. administration that now everybody is beginning to realize is we have an administration which is supporting the derivative economy and is sacrificing resources. We've now passed with the bailouts, and particularly with this last money from the IMF. The bailouts now are totaling, depending on how you count them, $12 to $15 trillion IMF and U.S. If you count other countries, it's more. And to put that number in perspective, it's now greater than all residential mortgages in the country. So depending on how you count residential mortgages, we have $9 to $12 trillion of residential mortgages, and now bailouts in excess that amount. So imagine instead of giving the money to the banks, if we had just simply retired all mortgages in the country, the difference it could have made to the economy. So it's just to put into perspective that we're seeing this tension coming to a head. Another great piece from USA Today, communities print their own currency to keep cash flowing. We're now seeing towns who tried to do a community currency coming back and doing it. Small businesses getting together and issuing currencies. Remember, years ago, I now bank at a community bank, and up on their walls, they have pictures of the currency they used to issue literally 100 years ago. So small businesses, communities printing their own currency. One of the conversations you're going to see coming up a lot more over the next year is alternative currencies and how we print our own currencies. And in fact, what you'll find is there's tremendous amount of economic activity that wants to happen in a local area, but literally can't with the official currency. And so community currencies really, and barter systems trap or capture a lot of that opportunity. I wanted to talk a little bit when we've gone through the line, the timeline of what I call the shakeout, which, as you remember, starts with the election, then the inauguration, then the March 15th with corporate disclosure dates, a lot of pension fund investments, huge investments announced but haven't gotten a lot of press attention. We're coming into one of the most sensitive dates, which is April 15th, and the tension is extraordinary. The different reports I get from the Solari Network of really the economic pain is tremendous. Shadow Stats reported, and it's up on the blog, that the real unemployment rate, according to their calculations, is 19%. If you add to it what is called underemployment, people working for much less than they are used to working for or working part-time, my guess is the number, you know, underemployment and unemployment, real unemployment, take us up to 40 or 50%. So the pain coming into the tax date is incredible. Now, one of the things I said is the next period of tension is the summer, rising into the fall, and one of the big tension places or tension spots is going to be state and local government municipalities. And sure enough, we saw today, and it's up at the top of the blog, an article in the New York Times called Small Towns, Big Debt, about a Memphis firm, so close to my home because I live about an hour and 15 minutes away from Memphis. A Memphis firm, Morgan Keegan, which is owned by a regional bank, Regions Bank, which is out of Birmingham, is one of the advertisers who most holds themselves out as being green and big on community service. So this is their brokerage unit, has now gotten 38 towns and communities in Tennessee to engage in interest rate swaps on variable rate debt instead of doing the sort of standard conservative fixed rate debt. And it tells the story of one of these towns, Lewisburg, Tennessee, which is a very poor community, and who have now discovered that their annual interest rate payments has quadrupled to $1 million a year. Well, in a county, in a town like Lewisburg, I can't tell you what a shocking number this is and what impact it could have. Now, if we keep going and looking at the press, the Wall Street Journal had an article on the right-hand side today that 10 states have had such dramatic declines in either sales tax or income tax that they're having to look at raising their taxes. Now, that's just the beginning. What we're going to see, a lot of municipal entities, whether state or local, have their fiscal year ending June 30. So after April 15th, one of the tension spots is going to be coming into that June 30 deadline. And what's important to understand is that a municipality, both a state and local government, must balance their books. So unlike the federal government, they can't print more money or go out and borrow money, more money. They have to lay off. They have to cut programs. They have to raise taxes. And so what's going to come out is that a lot of the banking shenanigans are going to hit the municipalities. The Morgan Keegan example is one that's going to hit their budget directly. The other one that's going to hit their budget very hard starting June 30 is going to be increased pension fund contributions from the huge losses that have occurred in the pension funds. Now, different laws and legislation have taken place to try and relieve some of that, but it's going to hit very hard. And again, what that means is we, the citizen, the user of municipal systems and services, is going to start to feel this very much. You're hearing reports around the country of rising property taxes. This is the beginning, but sales and income tax and cutback in services is going to start to come. I had an article several weeks ago by Pete Heckman up on the blog, which Pete's a wonderful retired city manager for a small town in Michigan. And what it describes is, I asked Pete, I said, look, a lot of people really have not been aware of their municipality or their county. They don't know their town managers. They don't know their local sheriff. This is not sort of something that they've been aware of. And I said, Pete, could you write me an article that tells people how to interact with their municipal management in a way that builds a positive relationship? And so he wrote a very interesting article and talked about what are the uses of time in a municipality and how can you not waste the city manager's time and start to do things in a way that interact with them in a positive way. But I really encourage all of us, because there's a game of musical chairs happening, and more often than not, city and state government are going to be the losers, and the chairs are going to get pulled. And that's the time when you want to be aware of what your county or town or municipal governance is. You want to know your sheriff. You want to be in communication, because you do not want to be surprised in some of the things that could happen. As many of you who've been listening to Solari Report know, one of the things I'm extremely concerned about is as the chairs get pulled in the game of musical chairs, that there'll be tremendous pressure on municipalities to privatize their assets, particularly in some areas. You have the municipalities owning utilities, water, other parks, other really precious private assets, municipal assets. And we want to make sure if those gets privatized, they get privatized. There's no reason we should all be sending our capital to Wall Street and let those get privatized and some corporation come and buy them out from under us. Let's buy it for ourselves. And that's going to be one of the opportunities and one of the terrible things that could happen if we don't understand it. I'm going to talk later about the international, as I said, but one of the things I want you to understand, and one of the reasons I really encourage you to see the movie, is this model of getting households and towns and states and counties dependent on debt is really an instrument of control. It's not just a way for the banks and the powers that be to make money. It's really a way for them to create or to destroy financial sovereignty in a way that gives them far more control of policy and practices within that place. And that means that they have the relationships in the municipal government and enforcement that allow them to bring in and do a whole lot of things that we don't necessarily want in our community. So, as I said, we're going to be talking in May or June about how to map out your local ecosystems. But my prediction for all of us is that place is going to start to get much more important, and understanding and knowing our place, whether it's knowing our neighbors, knowing the local sheriff and police, knowing who the city managers are, knowing what the process of governance is our place, and being in conversation with it is going to become more and more important to our safety and our quality of life. So I just encourage you to watch that story. In closing, let me just say again, this summer, to keep watching the shakeout after the tax date, April 15th, watch for the tension with municipalities, state, and local government, the pressure that puts on Congress as they start to negotiate the federal budget for the next year. We come into September in the to have the reconciliation. The budget is supposed to be in place by October 1st, and then October is the month that the market digests sort of the good news and the bad news, and that's one of the reasons that October is the month in the stock market that we sometimes see the big falls. A lot of times I get asked about the recent stock market rally. I would say beware, beware, beware. My bet is that this is a bear trap rally. And if you look at where the stock market has traded in terms of price earnings multiple in prior recessions or depressions, and you look at what's happening to corporate earnings, we could withstand not just big drops from here, but enormous drops. So we're not through the shakeout yet. We have a ways to go, and so beware the bear trap rally. So with that, let me, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, so Franklin, you know, it's funny, I've worked with precious metals now. For everybody who's listening to this call, what you need to know is Franklin is a great, you know, precious metals expert. He's been doing this and has very decades of deep experience and knowledge. I'm relatively new to this. I just came to precious metals in about 2000. And so, Franklin, it's been 9 years now. And when I first started to you know, buy precious metals and understand precious metals and talk to people of precious metals, when precious metals would take these drops, it would just knock my socks off. I would faint. I was like, oh, my God, you know, the end of the world is coming. What is going on? And, of course, now I've gotten immune. And what I occasionally realize is I'll get all these emails from subscribers as the price drops saying, oh, my God, what is happening? Is the end of the world coming? You know, should I get out of precious metals? Is it over? And so we've had one of those swoons. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about what's been going on in the market and what's happening and what you think it means.
Well, I think, you know, the first thing, the place I would like to start is for your listeners to put themselves in the position of one of the nice government men, which is what I call them, the MGM, who manipulate the market. And if you're going to manipulate a market, you don't go in and throw your resources at a market that's in a runaway upward move. You wait until the market is naturally weak. That is, you know, it's expended a lot of effort in getting up higher. And then when it starts to weaken off and it's about to correct, then you slam it.
Right.
That's the time you come in and hit it. And it's not accidental that in that case, first of all, you saw the European Central Bank announce that they had sold 32.5 tons of gold.
And that was coming into the G20 meeting.
Which was coming into the G20 meeting. And that, by the way, probably went to bail out Deutsche Bank on its gold shorts. But that's another story. And then you see, you heard leading up to things, you heard both Russia and China calling for a new international reserve currency that would be the SDR, which is the most, if you know anything about the institutional structure of the IMF or the SDR, that's ridiculous. It's like, you know, the stuff that you find under your bed, the dust bunnies that you find. It's like talking about making an international currency based on dust bunnies.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, they floated all these rumors, which are ridiculous. And then they pulled out the oldest dog of all,
The IMF gold sale.
That's right. And this has been going on since at least 1992 that I can remember, that every time the gold price threatens to go higher or every time they want to whack the gold price, they bring out this old dog. IMF ought to sell its gold to help the poor countries. Now, look, they couldn't even find the poor countries on a map. You and I both know that. And if they are poor, they're poor because IMF made them poor.
Right.
So this has been going on forever. They will not sell the gold. That is not going to happen because, I want you to think about this, Catherine, the international reserves of the United States government are 76% in gold. The reserves behind the dollar, the international reserves behind the dollar are 76% in gold. Now, why is that? Well, it's because nobody trusts the United States any more than they trust any of the other countries.
Right.
And the IMF, I don't know what the percentage would be for the SDR, but it's way, way lower than that. So the IMF is not, the SDR is not suitable. The gold behind the IMF, the IMF gold holdings, are not about to be sold. And they bring this thing out, they whack the gold market with it, and everybody goes running off. They're scared to death. They think, oh, that's the end of the gold bull market and so forth. And they don't think about time and price. Time and price.
Well, I think it's an excuse. I think they want to push the price of gold down using derivatives. And you know, one of the things that's so painful about the bailouts is we're watching the institutions that have used derivatives to push the price of gold down, getting their stores replenished. So they push the price down, they lose money, the government bails them out, and then they have the resources to push it down again.
Right. Well, they make money on the deal. They short all the way up, and then they engineer the rumors that drive the market down, and then they cover their shorts. The question is where they will cover the shorts this time. But if you take a long view, you know that the requirements of this bull market for time and price have not anything like been fulfilled yet.
Right.
I mean, you've got a fourfold increase from the bottom at 252. Okay, well, that's nice, but that's not a bull market top. And you've been running since 2001, so that's 8 years or 7.5 years. That's not enough time to fulfill the length of a bull market. So you have to stop and think about those things and console yourself and steady yourself with a long-term view. Then the next specter that rises up out of the ground to meet us is the deflation specter. And goodness gracious, there are people out there who can write the most blood-curdling articles about how deflation is going to take us over, it's going to eat us alive, and so forth. And I pay careful attention to those because I am very much aware that if deflation overtakes us instead of inflation, I will have misled thousands of people to the exact wrong investment. In other words, I will have put them into gold and silver when in fact they should have been putting their money into dollars and into government bonds.
Well, but I would disagree with that because I think that the deflation scenario is one where gold performs.
Well, that's another technical question because if you look at Roy Jastrom's work, Jastrom studied gold and silver from about 1450 forward. And what he found was that in deflations, gold and silver perform better than they did in inflations, which is logical if they are independent currencies, which is where we are now.
Right.
They're not pegged anymore. National currencies are not pegged anymore to gold or silver. And so now gold and silver are alternative currencies. So I think that probably would be true again. But nonetheless, we have to deal with all of these people who are not ignorant people. They're not stupid people who write these articles. But I think the thing that they miss is that the entire institutional structure has been reworked since 1934 to promote inflation and specifically to make sure that deflation never takes hold. There's a good reason for that. The reason is because the central bankers and the establishment that runs the financial institutions understood in the 1930s there was nothing they could do to stop the deflation once it took hold.
Right.
And so since that time, and remember, you know, they've had 75 years to do this. They have built in all sorts of automatic circuit breakers that automatically force the government to spend more money. They automatically address the problems that emerged in the deflation of the Great Depression. There is unemployment insurance, there's Social Security, there's welfare. That's just part of it. There are all these other automatic circuit breakers, plus the extraordinary things that the government does, all of the bailouts, and now Bernanke going around the banks to put money into circulation, to loan money, which is creating money, increasing the money supply. All of these things are aimed at making sure that deflation never happens. And one of
if you look at the latest monetary aggregate base, the MCM, for the last month, it's down 41%. Now, that's off of a huge increase in bubble.
But right.
The most recent statistics look deflationary.
Well, okay, but first of all, let's start with definitions. Deflation is not dropping prices. Deflation is a decrease in the money supply. Okay, so that's why your statistic is very important. Inflation is an increase in the money supply. I think that what happened was the Fed, Bernanke, and the Treasury they've taken a calculated risk. And what they've said is, we have got to get money into circulation to keep the system from imploding. And we will run the risk of hyperinflation in order to do that. We're in a crisis. Right now, we're going to bail the boat out. And that means inflating. And we'll worry about dealing with all the cans that we bail the boat out later. That's inflation. And so they have taken this calculated risk where they have engaged in a massive, massive increase or potential increase in the money supply through these bailouts. And they've said to themselves, well, we'll soak that up later. We'll figure out a way to deal with that later. And what we see is that all the asset bubbles, the commodity bubble, the real estate bubble, those things are dropping now. And the prices of those are, quote, deflating, but that's not deflation. That's falling prices.
Right.
And the cause of that is not a decreasing money supply. The cause of that is the realizers waking up and saying, hey, this stuff isn't worth what we were paying for it. And the healthy course would be to let real estate prices drop until a house becomes affordable and a good bargain again, to let all these other things drop, to let the companies that are no good go bankrupt, and then that would purge the system of all the debt that's been built up that's not really sustainable, and the asset prices that have been built up on the basis of that debt. The government has shown they are not willing. The government, the Fed, have shown that they are not willing to take that course.
That's interesting. They were willing to take that course in 1989 more than they are now.
You mean in the savings and loan crisis?
Right. So the last time we had sort of an engineered housing bubble, they let a lot more of the market find its level. And I remember, you know, the policymakers in 91, 92, 93 crowing about the fact that we allowed that to happen here where Japan didn't, and so our economy would be much stronger.
Well, I think one of the things that you have to understand about the property bubble is the pump and dump aspect of
right.
it. And you've talked about that a lot. And that is namely, they pumped it up. People like Goldman Sachs put together these mortgage-backed securities. They sold them to people they viewed as suckers around the world. They sold them overseas. And then when they were short, when they had sold them all off, then they crashed the market. Now they go back and they buy them back. And this deal that Geithner floated a couple of weeks ago, where the government would, I love the terminology. It's a public-private partnership. Okay, now think about this. The same thieves that floated the paper in the first place, that blew up the mortgage bubble in the first place, shorted it at the top, then they let it drop down to where it's 3 cents on the dollar. Now they're going to buy it back, and the crowning insult is that the government is going to loan them the money to do it.
Right.
And they have
trading
no recourse.
They're making another round of profits on trading sardines, so they're not real assets. And it's funny because, you know, for years I've been trying to communicate to the financial community that there's very significant collateral fraud. And I've, you know, it's very hard for a lot of those folks to fathom that what I'm saying is true. And when the Geithner plan rolled out, they basically, a couple of them came back to me and said, oh, my God, this is a shredding party.
Right.
You're right. You must be right. The only logical explanation for what's happening is that what you're telling us is true.
Right.
So
they made money by selling it in the first place. They shorted it. They cover it down low. And then after the government money comes in and drives the price back up to 85 cents on the dollar, they buy it at 3 cents on the dollar, ride it up to 85, and they get out again. It's a gigantic piratical raid on the whole American economy.
Right, it's a financial coup d'etat. And what's interesting is the administration is engineering it. We had the president say to the banks the other day that this administration is the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks. So we literally have an administration which is engineering into the private hands the equivalent of our entire national, you know, it took 200 plus years to create a $12 trillion national debt, and now they're engineering almost an equivalent amount into the banks in a year.
Right, but what better cover?
Right.
Think about it. They elect Obama on the idea that he's change, he's anti-establishment, he's, you know, the wave of the future, this, you know, the wonderful socialist who's going to make all the poor people good. And in fact, he's nothing but a tool of Wall Street.
Well, it's funny. In the quarterly wrap up, I refer to Obama as the change bankers. Count on for change bankers we're hoping for.
Right, exactly. So let me go back to the gold and silver markets. So
okay.
What we've seen happen is you saw an advance in gold up off a low in November. and it came up from $880 to $1,000. From $705 to $1,000, which is a huge
increase. Huge move.
Yeah, and then $1,000 is a psychological point, very important. But also, I was talking to a friend of mine who this week who worked 20 years for the Federal Reserve, for one of the Federal Reserve banks, and he's very, very well connected. And he says he thinks that the Fed was holding the line on gold at $1,000, and now they've pretty much raised that to $1,200. So, see, this is what they just try to moderate the rise.
Right.
They try to keep the rise to like 15-16% a year so that the public generally does not wake up to the fact that gold is running away. And that's basically what we're seeing now. So we had that 705 low during the panic last fall, ran up to $1,000. Gold now is correcting, and you have to add to this the seasonal pattern that normally there is a seasonal high in gold in the spring, and then it moves down into a low in June and July, and then moves back up into a high in October, and then another low in November, December. So it may be that the high we saw in February at $1,000 was the seasonal high. But there's reason to believe that we may see a seasonal high later this year in May or so before we go down into that, June, July low. And, of course, there's nothing set in concrete about that seasonal pattern. It's just an average of trading over the last 35 or 40 years. But it's not clear to me yet what the outcome of that will be. But we're in a correction. We went down, we went up, and now we came down again. And if we haven't already seen the bottom, the low probably on gold will be about $850. And the low on silver, $12, maybe $11.50, something like that. And as I said, we may have already seen the low because
one of my theories, Franklin, about what's happening in the precious metals market really relates in the general economy is I think the money supply is a function not just of what the central bank and the treasury does, but of the natural multiplier effect of people sort of being confident in the system and being willing to spend or invest or, cycling their money in a variety of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we've been watching is literally institutions no longer trusting each other and citizens and consumers no longer trusting institutions. And you're getting a pullback. And as it pulls back, the question for many people is, okay, well, where can I safe haven? Traditionally, that's been in the fixed income markets and the bonds. If you're worried about the dollar, that's sort of nerve-wracking. If you're worried about the banks, then CDs are nerve-wracking. And then, if you're worried about municipal bonds, we just had an article today. Moody's has put out a credit watch on all U.S. municipal bonds. now the gold market is very interesting in that upside-down triangle I talked about that I had up on the blog.
Mm-hmm.
You have the planet with $55 trillion of gross national product, and then it lists the silver and gold inventory at $2 to $4 trillion, and then derivatives at $1,200 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you look at the size of the derivative market and the bond market relative to how much gold and silver is outstanding, gold and silver markets are tiny.
Oh, yeah.
They're just tiny, and so I think the more people get concerned about lawlessness and moving away from central banks and governments, not trusting them. And I think, every day, no matter what they do, there's something else to inspire you to a greater sense of lack of confidence in these guys.
Right, and I think, there's another thing that shows the degree to which the public is trying to get away from what they don't trust, and that is the level of the premiums in the gold and silver market, in the retail market. By premium, what I mean is the amount you have to pay above the melt value of the gold or silver item that you buy. And we see premiums now higher than I've ever seen them.
Really? Even with the drop?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the drop just brings in more buyers. And, of course, the U.S. men, and this is only accident, I'm sure this is just a coincidence. I'm sure this doesn't have anything to do with the Treasury's policy, but suddenly they find themselves unable to mint gold and gold coins. I don't know why. You know, I mean, I could go out and buy gold if I wanted to and mint it up into coins, but apparently the U.S. Mint doesn't have anybody who's that resourceful who can do that. And so what they do is they slow down the production of gold eagles. The premium goes up on them. They disappear from the market. They've only just now come back into the market after about a four-week lapse, and they've got a premium of about 10.5% on them. Well, you know, see, all of these things like crashing the market, continuing to crash the market, always keeping the market unstable, keeping it off of balance. This is part of government policy, I have no doubt. This is a conscious government policy.
Well, I would say, because I don't think it's government, because I think the government is, you basically have the New York Fed member banks,
mm-hmm.
and they're picking the, as a practical matter, they're picking the Secretary of the Treasury.
Right.
And so I think you have sort of a little group of people who manage the currency in the markets, and it's a public-private partnership, if you will.
You're right. Where private is much of the bigger partner than public is. Well, I don't disagree with that at all. But the fact is that these people who run the Fed, the people behind the Fed, I'm not talking about Bernanke, who's just a functionary, but the people you're talking about who really run things and own things, they're the ones that can keep this continual policy of instability in the gold and silver markets to try and keep them
right, because they can turn a profit manipulating it.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
All right, but most of all, it is the safety valve. It is the safety valve, the blow off valve that tells anybody who knows anything, hey, if gold and silver are going up, if they're blowing off, then there's a problem in the U.S. dollar, and that's what they have to. That's what they have to manipulate.
Now, one question I have is whether or not you think they're doing off-market swaps and sales into China and Russia. Because I think part of the noise from Russia and China is they want to buy in quantity.
Well, you know, there's precedent for that in that the you remember the gold auctions in the 1970s.
Right.
The first half of the 1970s. That was nothing more than a way to give gold to the Arabs in exchange for all the petrodollars that they wanted to recycle. And so it would, you know, certainly the Chinese are no fools, and they know that they're the losers in the currency game right now. So it would not be surprising to me if that were true, yeah.
Right. I think what they're saying is, you want us to keep buying treasuries, then, you know, we have to get a certain percent in gold.
Right, right.
Now, one of the questions we got, Franklin, was on platinum.
Mm-hmm.
And so... you know, question number one for you is, do you follow platinum? And if somebody's interested in platinum and platinum compared to gold and silver, how would they start to learn about it?
Johnson, number one, I don't much follow platinum anymore, and the reason is that the platinum market is, platinum and palladium are both very quirky. About 75% of the platinum comes from southern Africa, and specifically from Zimbabwe and South Africa, and it's just reversed on the palladium. Most of the palladium comes from Russia with the gigantic Norilsk deposits, the Norilsk nickel mine, and most of the palladium comes from there. So both of those commodities are pretty strongly influenced by politics. And then secondly, they both have large primary uses in the automobile industry. And I personally have not followed it lately, but I've noticed that the platinum and palladium prices have been rising, which I find very interesting because they've been moving counter to gold and silver. I'm not against investing in platinum or palladium. It's just that it's somewhat difficult to do now because the U.S. government stopped minting platinum coins, so you have to buy 10-ounce bars, or you it's just not easy to get, or you have to get it in an inconvenient form like a 10-ounce bar.
So it's fair to say it's less liquid.
Oh, it's much less liquid, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And remember, these are markets that are far, far smaller than the silver market. So they're
right, which is tiny.
Right, which means that they're going to be even more volatile than the silver market. But for anybody who wants to know, Johnson Matthey, who's a worldwide refiner and processor of precious metals, publishes the benchmark platinum report every year. And you can get that. I don't know if you can download it from their website, but you can get that from them. And it is the accurate final word in platinum and palladium demand and use. So if I were interested in either of those metals, that's what I would do. I'd get that report first.
Okay. Okay, well, you've been very kind. We had many requests after our last precious metal update for more detail on trading the silver-gold ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And you were very generous, prepared a great deal of charts. They're up on the blog. We have a blog post on trading the silver-gold ratio. It links to another blog post with all your charts. So if anybody wants to follow along, you just go to the blog and walk off of that. But maybe if you could just walk us again through what trading the gold-silver ratio is, and then the history of the silver and gold ratio and what it says about how we should approach doing this now.
Okay, well, what you have to first begin with the understanding that both gold and silver are severely undervalued in historical terms right now. And of the two, silver is undervalued probably four times as much as gold is. If I had a chart that was 45 feet long, in which every foot represented one century of human history, the silver-gold ratio would be below 16 to 1 for all except the last 15 inches.
Wow.
So you see that when, in other words, it took 16 ounces or less of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold for all except the last, say, century and a quarter of human history. Only in 1941 and in 1991 has the ratio ever gone up to 100 to 1. So silver has been much more undervalued than gold is. So what we've seen is, and I put up the chart, the ratio from 1792 until the present, and it's very obvious from that chart that in this century, about 1918, and then again in 1967 and in 1980, you had severe corrections of that ratio that went down below 16 to 1. And there's something called reversion to the mean that everyone who trades markets knows about, and that is that markets tend to go back to their average. And if we look at the average for silver and for the gold-silver ratio for the last 200 years, it's about 32 to 1. But another thing that happens is that when markets do go back to their mean and revisit their mean, they go past that. They're like a pendulum that swings way over one way and then it swings way over the other way too. And that's what we've seen in the gold-silver ratio, where it's gone back to 16 to 1 three times in the last century. So let's just say that gold and silver doesn't do
anything. What is it today?
Okay, well, today it's about 72, a little less than 72. So it takes 72 ounces of silver to buy
one ounce.
And
what's the highest it's ever been?
100 to 1.
100 to 1.
Okay. 1991, 1941, 50 years separated.
I hope you bought silver in 1991.
I've been buying silver all along. I've got it a while to go. So what that means is, from where we are now, assuming that history is a guide, then we can expect silver to rise about four times as fast as gold will. And what that does is it gives us an opportunity in the meantime, because markets don't go in a straight line, they go in zigs and zags. When the ratio gets down relatively low, we swap from silver into gold. And then when it goes back up, we reverse that trade and go the other way.
Is there any reason in terms of manipulating the precious metals markets that the government would want to keep silver very, very cheap?
Oh, they have to. They absolutely have to. Well, because everybody who watches the market understands the gold-silver ratio. And so if they see the gold price dropping down, and silver doesn't drop, they say to themselves, something doesn't smell right here. And so they, you know, they stay in metals instead of running out, which is the government, what the government wants them to do. So they have to manipulate the silver price down in order to manipulate the gold price down. And it's easier to manipulate silver because it's a smaller market, it's more volatile, and so it's much easier to do. And this is, you know, the, who Ted Butler is. He's written a lot
right.
about this. And you have these huge short positions in the silver market concentrated in a very few holders, primarily J.P. Morgan. So, yes, they, if I were going to hit markets, the order that I would go in is I would strike the platinum market first because my money would go the farthest there. It would have the greatest effect. And then I would strike the silver market if I wanted to get gold to go down. And, in fact, you know, we saw that in 1987 when you had the stock market crash and they wanted to manipulate the price. Gold went up to $500. They needed to manipulate the price of gold down. They went in, they hit the platinum market after hours and drove down platinum, and that scared people out of gold. So these markets are interconnected. But by swapping gold and silver, and we don't have to do this often. You know, we've done three trades since 2003. And
when were those? Do you remember when you did those?
We started getting out of gold and into silver on the way up to 80 to 1, which was in 2003. And then I have to admit, I missed a move and when it went down to 51 because I was waiting to 50, and it went to 51 and then turned around because there were a lot of hedge funds that were in it. So I missed that one, but we caught the next one when it went down to 43 to 1. So we had.
When was that?
That was in 2006. And then we got to go, 2 months later, we got to go back into silver. And the net result was that people who followed that strategy increased the number of ounces they held from 50 to 75%. Well, see, what we've done is we've taken an asset that is sterile, that doesn't throw off dividends, that doesn't pay interest, and we've made it increase.
Right.
So now, instead of holding 100 ounces of gold, we hold 175 ounces of gold.
Right.
Which I don't care what the gold and silver price is. That doesn't make a bit of difference.
But you have to be honest about this. What it does cost you is postage.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, that's exactly right. But the transaction, and there are transaction costs.
Right.
But the transaction costs are so small compared to, see, we don't ever do a move where we're going to make less than 30%. So the transaction cost in relation to the gain is so small.
So if I bought silver today at 72 to 1,
mm-hmm.
how much would it need to improve before there's a chance I could swap? What would it be? About
well,
50
it kind of depends on how hard we want to work it, but there's probably going to be a swap at about 57.5.
Okay.
And then it'll go down again, and we'll get a chance to swap at 40 or at 50. Then 43 is the next big line, and after that 38, and we'll see those points. But you have to realize that every time we get down there, we have to swap very quickly out of silver into gold, and then we ride it back up, and in about 2 months we get a chance to go back into silver from gold.
Right.
So, but it's not the kind of thing. I mean, we watch it for our customers, and it's not the kind of thing that they have to swap. They have to do all the time. That's what makes it good. And another thing that makes it good is I have more confidence in that trade than I do in a trade of gold and silver against dollars.
Right.
I know that one's going to work. And,
right.
And oftentimes it's screwy to people. You know, it messes with their understanding because we may sell gold at a lower price than we bought gold in order to go into silver and gain ounces, and in the end, we come out with a lot more ounces of gold than we started with. So dollar price has nothing whatsoever to do with it. The only thing we're looking at is how many ounces of silver does it take to buy an ounce of gold. And we just try to trade the zigs and the zags, only the very big ones, not the little bitty ones, only the very big ones. And it's so far, it's worked very, very well for us, and I think it'll continue to work because silver now, is on its way down to that 16 to 1 ratio. So that means it's going to gain more than four times as much as gold over the next few years.
Right, which is enormous.
Oh, yeah.
It's enormous.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I grapple with a lot, as you know, is what's going to happen to the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And I've decided, you know, you can't predict. You just have to. It's kind of like being a mama bear, and you just have to watch it. And the problem is when you have assets that are sitting in dollars,
mm-hmm.
they could go to zero overnight. Whereas if it's sitting in silver and gold, you know, it can go up and down, but it can't go to zero overnight.
Well, you know, one of the problems is, Catherine, that we all think in terms of dollars. The dollar is our numerator. That's the technical term. But if you think in terms of silver and gold, and this is what I've been, you know, pushing people to think of for years and years and years, the dollar is really actually what's volatile.
Right.
It's not the silver and gold. It's
right.
the dollar that's volatile.
Right.
And that, you know, people don't, they think, oh, well, I had $100 in 19 or in 2001, and I've got $100 today. It's still $100. It's not $100. It's not the same purchasing power. You've lost
more than 50%.
Yeah, I know. So, but we think in those terms, and we have to teach ourselves to think in terms of purchasing power, not in terms of dollars.
I talked during the last precious metals update. It took me several years to make the switch. And now I don't think in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because now, you know, working with the subscribers, I deal with a lot of people who do, and it's always kind of, oh, right, I remember when I used to think like that. But it's shocking. One of the things that helped me sort of make the switch very permanent was those charts that I put up of the performance of gold in 2008 in all these different currencies. You know, it was up 4% in the dollar. I don't know if I showed you this. Do you know offhand how much it was up in Icelandic currency?
Oh, goodness gracious, that's an infinite curve.
95%. It was up 95%. And so you see where you're in a place that's getting hit by serious economic warfare, then precious metals, what it's been doing around the world, is holding its value if you're in a place that gets hit.
Right. You know, it's like my philosophy on bar fights.
Yes.
Okay. You know, the way that you avoid a bar fight
uh-huh.
is not to be in the bar when the fight erupts. Okay. And
I think
the way
you went through this.
I'm very adamant about this. I don't like bar fights, and I don't want to be there when the fight breaks out. So it's the same way with dollar depreciation. You don't want to be there. You don't want to be part of the fight. You don't want to get mangled. Get out now.
Well, the only thing is, though, people have obligations in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be hedged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so we all have some kind of float in the dollar. One of the questions I get a lot, Franklin, is what will happen to my cash if a global currency gets issued? Will there be an Amero? What will happen to my cash? And one of the things I'd like to do on the Solaria Report is have we're going to next week. Dmitry Orlov is going to be on. And Dmitry was Russian. He moved to America when he was 12, but went back and forth to Russia and literally lived in a society where one day, you know, everybody was, you know, had saved their whole life. They had money in the bank. They had money in the pension funds. And they wake up the next morning and it's all worthless.
Right.
And it's phenomenal to talk with people who've lived through this experience. And, of course, one of the things that sort of torments me is, could we have a radical devaluation in this country where literally one day, you know, we wake up the next morning and something, you know, there's been a radical devaluation and gold's at 3,500 and the dollar is, you know, we all still have the same amount of dollars in our bank accounts, but they go far less.
You know what, I think Ned Schmidt made a point to me about a month and a half ago that really, really struck me as apt. And that is, he said, you know, people who were worried about their gold being confiscated, they can forget about that. They're not going to confiscate your gold. They're going to confiscate your wealth.
Right.
And he said, look at the model of Argentina under Perón, and you will get the picture. Or Argentina in the last 20 years, where you wake up one morning and you find that you still own the bank account, but you can't draw the money out.
Right.
or that your savings account has been converted, your IRA has been converted to government bonds, and you can't withdraw it. You're guaranteed 3% or something.
Well, but it's happening even now. You have all, you know, a large portion of your savings in a 401k, and you can't invest it in most of the investment opportunities worldwide because an American's not allowed to invest in all these different countries. You know, all these different countries. Our capital is frozen.
Right.
And we don't, a lot of times, we don't even realize it.
Well, you know what my customers call me up and say? They say, listen, I've got a 201k I want to convert. I said, what do you mean a 201K? He said, well, yeah, it used to be a 401K. And then the market went down, that's a 201K. So, you know, I think what you have to look out for is they're going to confiscate they're going to confiscate or sequester your wealth that is locked up in something like an IRA or even bank accounts, things like that. So you have to keep your exposure to that to a minimum.
Well, I just want to mention, because you and I are both in Tennessee, we did have a bit of good news last week.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I live right next to Whitefield, Tennessee, and a roadblock was planned as a joint venture between local enforcement and the military.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, the emails went out, and there was so much complaining to state representatives, it got canceled.
Right.
And the link about that is up to one of the forums on the blog that was instrumental in getting it canceled. But it just goes to show you that if we're willing to be active in the trench warfare of complaining about all this stuff, you can back it up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, what they're counting on is your inaction.
Well, I'm counting on our action. Okay, Franklin, before we close, anything else on trading the gold-silver ratio that you'd like to mention?
It's not a thing that you have to do over and over. We have opportunities from time to time, but if you're ready to do it and you just generally watch the market, you know, once a month really is enough that you can do it. But I really strongly encourage everybody to do that. It is the best way to really make your gold and silver investment work.
Right. Okay, well, Franklin, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, too.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, now let's go to the movies. As you know, I always say in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. And The International, which is a new thriller with Clive Owens, it's been in the theaters. It should probably be out on video. I put the trailer up on the blog post, and if you don't want to watch the movie or you don't have time to go see the movie, see the trailer, because the trailer does a very good job of communicating. We have a bank, and the bank presumably is sort of a fictional variation of the BCCI, which was the bank famous for sort of international money laundering that shut down in the early 90s. As a historical footnote, the American portion of the bank was First American. You might remember the brouhaha about Clark Clifford and the husband of Wonder Woman, the actress who played Wonder Woman, going through all sorts of legal hassles because they had allowed BCCI money to come in and buy this Washington Bank First American. First American was turned over under court control to a trustee, the trustee asked me if I would join as a member of the board and help him resolve and work out the situation. There was about ultimately $500 million plus that was recaptured, and the debate was, who was going to get the money? Was it the depositors? Was it the Department of Justice? Believe it or not, there was quite a squabble we had trying to get the Department of Justice from seizing the money. So inadvertently, I had the opportunity. I was sitting out in a house in McLean where I lived at the time, and a Brinks truck rode out that the trustee had sent with literally thousands and thousands of pages of legal document from our law firm in Washington. And I sat, the house was all glass overlooking the Potomac, so I sat in this living room for 3 days straight reading, I'm a speed reader, reading all these documents. And when I finished the final document, what I realized was, oh, my God, all of this was done with the full complicity of the National Security Council, the White House, the Treasury, the Federal Reserve. This was criminality at the highest institutional level. And it was basically institutionalized blessing of money laundering on an enormous scale. And what you see in the story, Clive Owen plays an Interpol agent who is trying to stop this bank, which is engaging in massive money laundering and criminality, and he's getting nowhere because all of his sort of, you know, his bosses and his bosses' bosses don't want the bank touched. Well, the bank is engaging in, among other things, engineering coup d'etats in poor countries and assassinating an Italian, very successful Italian businessman who's running for election in Italy. So they're engaging in sort of massive engineering of coup d'etats around the world. And what it all comes down to is a scene where one of the top bank executives explains to Clive Owens that basically their job in life is to get all of these third world countries basically in debt, and what they do is they use weapon sales and wars and a round of coup d'etat to kind of engineer the situation. And Clive does a series of things to very heroically bring down the current management, and sure enough, what happens is the bank doesn't go down. There's just a whole spate of press that kind of implies, you know, all sorts of official spin, and sure enough, the bank is revived, and off it goes again. And the message you get is, you know, this is not a rogue bank. This is an integral part of the actual system managing the planet, and the economy depends on a parasitic debt system which entraps countries, and if you want to extrapolate, which is very fair to do, and places and counties and municipalities and households, and basically forces and entraps them in debt, and uses assassination and dirty tricks to ensure that process has happened. And if anybody tries to stop it, you know, they're destroyed, and the criminals moved in instead to take over the country. And so you see the model, and you see it working very clearly in all its different parts. Now, it's not the most uplifting and entertaining movie because it's sort of depressing to face it. What I would say is the tremendous advantage to all of the people participating in the Soleri Report is if you watch it, if you understand it, if you understand the economic warfare and the economic hitman process enough so that you can start to see it around you, that's step one to having a map that's good and very useful to help you protect yourself and your family and your assets. And so, you know, maybe watch it and then make sure you you take a spa day or a break. Maybe watch it on Saturday night and have a great day on Sunday and get some rest and whatever, because it's a lot to digest. But The International with Clive Owens, I recommend it to you. It's it's a better representation of what's really going on in the economy than you'll ever read in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Not better necessarily than you get on the Soleri blog or you get in the Money Changer, which is Franklin's fabulous newsletter. So I recommend it. The International, if you haven't seen it in the theaters, it should be out in video sometime in the next 2 to 4 weeks. So with that, let's just talk about next week and the week after. As I said last week in our quarterly wrap-up, this week, this month, April, in the Soleri Report is contemplating the worst case. Next week, we have Dmitry Orlov, who is a Russian software programmer. He moved to the United States when he was 12 and then proceeded through family relationships to go back to Russia during the 90s when Russia went through the extraordinary economic collapse. And Dmitry has done a series of articles on comparing what happened in Russia and the United States, and if really dire economic times came, what the lessons learned from Russia might say about what could happen in the United States. And he finally published about a year ago a very good book. It's short, it's easy reading, called Reinventing Collapse. Now, Dmitry is a much greater believer in the collapse scenario than I am. But as I said before, and I'll just keep saying it again and again, the great thing about contemplating collapse scenarios and talking to people who really think we're headed into happening in the United States, what happened to Russia, is it really inspires you. You know, the kind of, you listen to Dmitri, it scares you to death. You go off and you do a whole series of things that, that he recommends or you're inspired to do as a result of it. And interestingly enough, if the collapse never happens, those are great investments of your time and resources for other scenarios. Anything that makes you more self-sufficient really protects you in the scenario I call the slow burn, which is not a collapse. It's just a constant drain by these financial mechanisms. So Dmitri Orlov next week, if you haven't read Reinventing Collapse and you want to read it before, I really recommend it. It's a terrific book. And then the following week will be Cliff High with Half Past Human, and I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. We won't have movies with Dmitri and Cliff because we got plenty to talk about. And so, again, April's going to be worst case month, and we're going to explore a lot about the worst case next week and the following week. So with that, that's it for this evening, and I just want to thank you again for joining. I really want to thank you for the questions and feedback. Again, it was your feedback that inspired me to ask Franklin to prepare those charts and do dig in more to trading the gold-silver ratio. So keep the feedback and the suggestions coming, and we'll try and be responsive to them. So until next week with Dmitri Orlov, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.